Sairam, dear listeners, Radio Sai welcomes you once again to listen to Professor Venkatraman deliver his second talk in this new series titled Relevance of Moral Values in the Globalized Age. Over now to Professor Venkatraman.
Dear listeners, loving Sairam and greetings from Prashanti Nilayam. This is my second talk in the current bi-weekly talk series. And just to remind you, my goal is to explore the basic question as to whether it is at all possible to have a global society in this day and age that is totally lacking core non-negotiable moral values. This issue I shall discuss by considering various aspects of life as it is at the present time, always keeping an eye on how globalization is pressurizing people to either forget or even deliberately abandon moral values, values which people in earlier times always abided by, in fact for several millennia. The topic I have chosen for today is stability, growth, and slow adaptation to changing conditions. Clearly, this topic is quite different from what I discussed last time. However, it is through such talks, each with its own theme, that I expect to address the basic question which I have just raised, namely whether moral values are indispensable or not. But before I get to today's topic, there is something else I just have to get off my chest because it relates to a profound quote of Einstein that was sent to me recently. This quote is very special because it is an uncanny anticipation of the situation towards which humanity seems to be currently heading. But first, I should give you some background pertinent to this quote. And after that, I shall give you the quote itself. About 35 to 40 years ago, many eminent sociologists used to say, folks, machines are improving so much and removing human drudgery so fast that soon you would have to work only for 3 days in a week. So, start planning right now about how to enjoy 18 days of leisure every month. This was the forecast that many eminent sociologists made about 35 years ago. Most of you, including many of my age, might not have heard this, and this remark of mine might come as a huge surprise. And you may even wonder, really? Did somebody ever make a forecast like that? I don't recall any such thing. Quite possibly that is true. That is because this kind of discussion was restricted to a limited circle of intellectuals, and I happened to hear about it by chance because of my avid radio listening at that time to the Voice of America and the BBC. Well, what actually happened subsequently is an entirely different story. Yes, the machines did come as predicted, but instead of increasing leisure, factory workers began losing their jobs, first in a trickle and later in tens of thousands every month. In short, machines began to contribute to unemployment and there was no question of leisure. Now, just consider this. On December 1, 1913, Henry Ford, I'm sure everybody has heard of his name, Henry Ford launched the assembly line for the efficient mass production of cars, and he reduced the time it took to build a car from more than 12 hours to 2 hours and 30 minutes. That was in 1913. I visited a modernized Ford plant in 1968, and I was stunned to see that one car rolled off the assembly line every 2 minutes. So from 2 hours and 30 minutes, it had been brought down to 2 minutes. Imagine that. At that time, the entire Ford Auto Works provided employment to thousands, many thousands. But from the net, I now find that a new car factory in China uses all kinds of robots for car assembly and so on, and runs the entire factory with just 60 people. Compare that. Thousands of people as opposed to just 60 people for manufacturing cars. You see how what is efficient for a corporation becomes a problem for society? The struggle between man and machine is a topic in itself, and I have to come back to it on a later occasion. But for now, let me draw attention to what Einstein said many, many, many years ago. He said, "I fear the day when technology will surpass our human interaction. The world would then have a generation of idiots." That is Einstein. Now, Mahatma Gandhi was also deeply worried about how in due course machines could even destroy the very soul of man. Not merely take away your job, not merely rob you of your leisure, but even destroy your soul. That's what Gandhiji was worried about. I'm sure many today would summarily dismiss the Mahatma's concern as benevolent nonsense. But in truth, Gandhiji's anxiety has proved to be amazingly prescient. As I said, I shall return to that topic in a later talk devoted entirely to man and the machine. Okay, let me now turn to the topic that I have chosen for this talk, which, as already mentioned, is stability, growth, and slow adaptation to changing conditions. Let me repeat that. Stability, growth, and slow adaptation to changing conditions. Now, what do I mean by stability, and why is stability important? Well, here is a simple example from nature. All of us know that Mount Everest is the tallest mountain on Earth. But have you ever wondered why there are no mountains taller than Everest? Suppose we extend the discussion and ask, what is likely to be the height of the tallest mountain on the Moon and Mars, and even say a neutron star? Is there any way of scientifically discussing this problem? To most people, such questions might seem ridiculous and a complete waste of time. But let me tell you, it is via such questions that great scientific advance is often made. My background is physics, and so let me explain how stability enters into deciding how tall a mountain can be. Now, mountains are usually formed when huge land masses on Earth collide. That, by the way, is how the Himalayas are formed hundreds of million years ago. Now, mountains rest on the land immediately below them, and the taller the mountain, the greater is the force that it exerts on the land below. If that force is very high, the pressure due to the mountain, the ground below becomes very hot due to compression, and it starts melting. So now the mountain is literally floating on molten rock, and it begins to sink into the molten rock it has produced by its own force. And it keeps on sinking until a balance is reached. The point to be noted is that the issue of stability arises whenever two competing factors enter the problem. Now, in the case of the mountain, one force, namely that which drives the mountain growth, pushes upwards to make the mountain as tall as possible. However, when a limit is crossed, the melting of the underlying rock opposes this growth and tries to bring the mountain down. Stability is reached when the two opposing forces are evenly matched. That is the first take-home lesson I would like you to bear in mind. For the record, let me say that the Himalayan region is still to settle down completely, and that's why we still have huge earthquakes there. Just recall the disastrous earthquake that struck Nepal recently. And by the way, the affected region was not far from the Everest. I don't know whether it's a coincidence, but that is a fact. Let me now give another example where the balance between the two competing agencies is not static, but dynamic. This problem is sometimes referred to as the prey-predator problem, and the reasons for that would become clear shortly. Consider two living species, both of which share the same living space. One of these species is the prey, while the other is the predator. For the sake of simplicity, let us suppose that the prey is a small fish, while the other, namely the big fish, is the predator. We further assume that both the small fish and the big fish live in the same village pond. Now, basically, the small fish eat lower organisms in the pond, like insects, algae or whatever it is, and that is how they survive. While the big fish survives entirely by eating the small fish. The small fish do not have to depend on anything other than what is available in the pond, and that's how they grow. But the big fish has to depend entirely on the small fish. Keep that in mind. However, when the big fish dies, the small fish get a huge bonus dinner, and hundreds of small fish feast on the carcass of the big fish. So they get something else other than their normal food. So, in a manner of speaking, the big fish eats the small fish to survive, while the small fish feed on the big fish whenever the latter dies. Together, these two species achieve some sort of equilibrium which is dynamical in nature. More explicitly, when the population of the small fish is large, the big fish have a plentiful supply of food which allows their population to increase. However, when the population of the big fish becomes very large, and it becomes large by eating a lot of the small fish, there are very few small fish left, and there is heavy competition among the big fish for the small fish or food. As a result, when the food supply diminishes for the big fish beyond a critical limit, the big fish start to die in large numbers due to starvation. But then, when most of the predators are gone, namely the big fish, the small fish breed safely, and their population, which was once abominably small, now starts increasing. In short, when the small fish thrive, the big fish have plenty of good hunting. At the other end, when the predators are small in number, the small fish prosper and multiply. Stated differently, the population of the prey, namely the small fish, and the predator, namely the big fish, vary in time in an oscillating fashion, with one being high when the other is low. This is what dynamical equilibrium or stability means. In nature, we never encounter such idealized model situations. Situations are always more nuanced, and I shall come to that a bit later. Meanwhile, in passing, I would like to point out that where adharma and dharma are concerned, there is a similar tussle that goes on through the ages. When dharma is strong, adharma is in check, and it is the other way when adharma gains ascendancy. In other words, social stability is determined by the tussle between these two primordial forces. I will say more about this in a later talk. In the example of the big and the small fish, I restricted myself to an isolated village pond. The real world is immensely more complex, and the issue of stability keeps on changing because the environment in which we all live also keeps on changing with time. Now, here is an example. You may not believe it, but about 700 or so years ago, the whole of England was full of thick forests in which lived hundreds of thousands of deer and also wolves. Like the small fish in the pond example, the deer, i.e. the prey, fed on the vegetation in the forest, while the wolves kept the deer population in check by being the predators for the deer, which obviously was the prey. This situation underwent a huge change when the human population in England grew to a point when humans began to hunt the deer in increasingly large numbers, for food of course. As is to be expected, one fine day the deer were almost all gone because all the forests had been almost cut down. And that is when man had to turn to farming for food. And that is how farming grew in England. Incidentally, when people from England landed on the east coast of North America, that region too was covered with thick forests, huge forests, right up to the Midwest. However, with the passage of time, the forests were systematically cut down in order to promote agriculture. That story of forest demolition is once again being played out on a global scale, especially during the last 4 decades or so. I do not know whether you are aware of the great rainforests on planet Earth. These great rainforests are to be found mainly in 3 parts of the world, namely South America, especially Brazil, Central Africa, and Indonesia. All these forests took a long time to come into existence. In fact, tens of thousands of years. These are not merely giant forests, but massive and enormously precious ecosystems in themselves. Okay, but why am I talking about these rainforests? There is an important reason. Now you know, plants, and that term includes trees, they perform a critical service to all creatures on Earth that need oxygen to breathe and live. How do plants provide this service? They do this by absorbing the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and using solar energy to produce oxygen, which is so vital for life. All this is explained in elementary textbooks, so I won't go there. What I would like to say is, the rainforests have literally been the lungs of the planet for thousands of years, giving oxygen not only to us humans who came late, but also to all the other species that roam the land. During the last few decades, huge swaths of the American forest have been cleared, A, for growing soya for export to China, and B, for rearing cattle for supplying beef to China and the Far East. China and the Far East never used to eat beef before, but now beef has become the main part of their food, displacing the traditional food they relied upon. Where Indonesia is concerned, they are clearing forests in order to grow palm trees and supply palm oil, for which there is a great global demand. In other words, when man and money come together, reason is often put aside, following which there is a train wreck. Till recently, this train wreck was being played out in slow motion, but aided by mass pollution of air, water and land, the train wreck is now playing out much faster. Okay, after all that gloomy news, it is time to bring in some harsh realities, and after that, Swami, of course. First, consider this. Let us say a man goes to a certain city on business and hires a room in a hotel or a motel for a few days, say a week. It is a common understanding that when the occupant leaves, he leaves the furnishings and fittings intact as they were when he first occupied it. Now, would it be okay for the temporary occupant to ruin the furniture, break the wash basin, damage the refrigerator and so on during his brief occupancy of 1 week or so? I'm sure all of us would say in union, such things are not acceptable and the occupant must not only be condemned but also taken to task. Very good, and keep that in mind. Now let us consider us humans as a whole. Our Earth was born about 15 billion years ago, and it took till about 100,000 years ago for humans to emerge finally as a species, Homo sapiens, and start wandering around and settle in different parts of the globe. You may be amazed to learn that it was only about 10,000 years ago, that humans learned to use fire, discover the wheel, domesticate some animals and start farming. All just 10,000 years ago. Human population crossed the 1 billion mark in 1804. And that roughly is when humans started ravaging the planet most thoughtlessly, thanks to many waves of industrial revolution. The industrial revolution, which came in waves, gave us powerful tools capable of ruining the delicate planetary ecosystem simply by being singularly irresponsible. Swami has explained it once, or in fact many times. And here is a paraphrase which I have put together, wherein I have put together many different quotes of Swami. Essentially, Swami says, every individual is just a short-term resident on the planet. When he or she arrived on the planet, the good Lord had already kept everything ready for the person concerned: air to breathe, water to drink, and land to live and prosper. But look at what humans have done to the planet. Humans often boast of their mighty capabilities. Can humans ever cause wind to blow as fiercely and as extensively as during a hurricane or typhoon or super cyclone? No, they can't. During such events, there is also heavy rain and billions of tons of fresh water pour from the sky. Can man do such things? Of course not. So what does man do? Driven by greed of various kinds and through the use of money, power and technology, man is thoughtlessly destroying the planet and its innumerable ecosystems in a great hurry. What right does a person have who is a mere transient resident of the earth to do all this? Man does not pay even rental charges for living on earth, which you do in a hotel. So what right does a man have, to whom I gave free air, free water and free land? What right does such a person have to destroy what he did not create? In fact, man has not only grabbed these free gifts of God, but also dares to sell them as if he owns them. First he found how to grab land and sell it. Next he grabbed water and started selling it. So far, man has not found a way to sell air, but it appears that he has made a beginning by selling oxygen. I tell you, Mother Nature is capable of great patience, but when she is pushed beyond a limit, she can get mighty angry. And when Mother Nature gets furious, you better watch out. I will not intervene and simply let her teach you a lesson. Dear listeners, if we reflect deeply, we would realize that it is the mind that traps us into stupidity, which is self-destructive. And the only way to avoid such drastic mistakes is, as I hinted earlier, 1. Bow to moral values laid out by the Almighty Himself. 2. Appreciate that these laws transcend physical reality. And 3. These laws have to be adhered to always and unconditionally. That is to say, they are non-negotiable. In other words, moral values are ordained by divinity and hence they are absolute, period. Thus it is better for us to bow to God-given moral laws than pretending that God does not exist and try to do as we please. Yes, we can give disobedience a shot, but there is always a price to pay, and that price would be exceedingly high. Is it worth courting disaster at that price? Think about it. That's all for today, and thanks for listening. Goodbye, all the best, and Jai Sai Ram.
Sai Ram, dear listener, this is Radio Sai Studio back again, and that concludes Professor Venkatraman's second talk in the new series that he has started. In the normal course, the next talk in the series should have been aired on 24th November. However, since that date comes immediately after Swami's birthday, we are doing some rescheduling. Hence, please stay tuned to our service and watch out for the announcement for the next talk, which we expect would be in early December. Meanwhile, we hope you found this talk interesting and useful. As always, do write back to us with your comments and observations, as always, to listener@radiosci.org. Thank you for listening and giving Radio Sci the privilege of serving you. Jai Sai Ram.